So the part I'd like to talk about tonight is the parts, the fives. Five flavors, five petals, five positions. We started with, Janai started with that the double fire hexagram when she gave her talk and invoked that. In the double fire hexagram, the relative and absolute interpenetrate. Piled up, they become three. The permutations make five. Like the taste of the five-flavored herb, like the five-pronged diamond thunderbolt. Subtly included within the truth, drumming and singing fit together. So Tozan created a way of looking at interpenetration called the five ranks. Now, interpenetration, which is really what we're going to be, what I want to talk about, was a Chinese sort of extension or revisioning, not extension, revisioning of interdependence, our classic interdependent co-arising. That's a category he used to call it. Interdependent co-origination, that was his phrase. And although they're long syllables, it kind of had a lilt to it after 1,000 repetitions. Interdependent co-origination. The way each thing arises, relying on a sea of causes and conditions. Everything arising and passing away in connection with, not just in connection with, but made up, affected by, sent that way, sent up out of causes and conditions, kind of disappearing into and out of causes and conditions. And that this is the signal quality of all life, that we call a change or impermanence is just another face of the same world of cause and effect, which one time looks through time like impermanence, and another looking at more in terms of space and thingness we call interdependent things. It's the same one reality. So in China, a Buddhist philosophical school called Huayan developed that was allied to a lot of Zen masters were kind of in that as well. But that was just basically a philosophical school, and there was one of the great Indian sutras, the Flower Garland Sutra, great in many ways, great long, and great in depth. They took as the basis for this understanding of the interpenetration of all things. And Huayan as a school sort of continued, but in a very small way. In Japan, it's the Kagon school. But they didn't have a lot of practice. They were philosophers, and of course, Buddhist priests did ritual. But those who wanted to practice and have an unpracticed experiential understanding of interpenetration practiced Zen in China at the time. So there was a co-mingling. And approach to seeing in terms of the interpenetration of all things was very influential in Soto Zen. Also Rinzai, who picked up these five positions. So all of Zen was deeply influenced from the first in China and then continuing in Japan. So he created a way of looking at interpenetration. The whole poem is about interpenetration of each thing made of the other. Coextensive with the other, with all the others. And he created a system called the five ranks, which is a terrible name for it, or five positions, as a way of trying to get a handle on comprehending this interpenetration of all things. So I don't like ranks because it's not status, it's not comparing, and it's not a graded system. It's not a linear thing or a graded system. So ranks is really, at least in English, an awkward word for it. So they are five interlocking standpoints, each of which expresses reality. They're simultaneous. We talked about the host within the host. That's one of them. The host and, yes, the relationship, basically, of many and one, or of the many myriad phenomena and whatever you might call unity or oneness or absolute. How do these connect and relate? Well, they were never separate to begin with, but the mind has separated them. And so then we try to bring them together again. and find that the taking apart and bringing together what was originally not divided is will add to our understanding. You know, in that taking apart and putting together, so they started grading our property yesterday, doing this massive regrading because the ground slopes to the house on three sides and creating a swimming pool under the house whenever it rains. So it's a massive effort. And what one piece is that there was very little on the property. So I'm very grateful for the tree money I got for my birthday, because there's one tree. There were two diseased trees and one good tree. Now there's one tree on the property. It's beautiful, huge mulberry, and a lot of concrete. These people loved concrete, so there were concrete curbs and walkways and things. And we wanted to get a lot of the old concrete out. And since we have these big machines, it's not Hugo and a sledgehammer. It's a great big excavator and a beautiful detailed work. I mean, it's like doing surgery with a scope, you know, with your hands. That he can take this large scoop and manipulate it beautifully with skill. So one of the first things he did was take out, there's a walkway out from the back of the house to the garage, old concrete walkway. And while that was there, it was very clear that on one side there was a kind of an area where you could make a kind of a garden, and we'll plant a tree and we'll put in our little fountain that granite fountain will eventually have a home that's been carted around all these years. And on the right, there was a gravelly area between the house and the garage, and well, you know, he put a clothesline there. And then he removed the concrete walkway. And immediately they were not two separate areas, there was just one continuous area. It had been impossible to see it as one continuous area, one yard garden area behind the house that extends in both directions, because there was this division in the middle. And like just like our minds and our words, the word arbitrarily goes, you know, from here to here. Blue goes from this in the spectrum to this in the spectrum. And these different in different cultures. So artificially, kind of from here to here, this is the content of this word. From here to here is the content of this word. This is outside the meaning of that word. And we accept that. We work with it. We need to work with it. But we then don't realize how many concrete barriers we've created by assuming that what is inside is inside, what is outside is outside. And this separation of things. So this concrete sidewalk disappeared, and all of a sudden, there was one continuous area, where it had been impossible to see one continuous area just because there was a divider in the middle of it. In front of the property, it wasn't quite as dramatic, but almost, because there was what I call the racing oval in front. The whole front of the property pretty much was given to a huge circular driveway, extended all the way around, and a huge interior area that had a big concrete curb all the way around it. This is, we're talking about something that's basically almost 100 feet long and 70 feet long. It's just an immense driveway. And pillars, too. But once this concrete oval was gone, all of a sudden, the land was continuous instead of chopped up. Now, that one we knew would look different. But in back, take away an artificial or arbitrarily put in separator, and the whole way of perceiving changes. So it's not that we shouldn't use words, but we need to have some awareness of the way they can be compelling, and the way we get we turn them into blinders instead of words. They run us instead of us running them, is kind of what winds up happening. So I don't like ranks. I like five positions, five standpoints. They are simultaneous, and they're not just aspects either. I saw another translation, sort of five aspects of the way things are. But their aspects are like two different from each other, and each of these is a complete description of how things are. From one window, from another. Like here's the window of impermanence, here's a window from interdependence, and there are five different windows here. So I'll use position, condition, whatever else I'll come up with here. I'd love to hear other words that come to you. At the end of this, if any other words for the five come to you, I'd love to hear them, because we need all the creativity of renaming things in that way that we can come up with. So in the double fire hexagram, I used to do the I Ching, but it's been a very long time. It was with a Carl Wilhelm translation, and it was at any rate, it's been a very long time. Double fire hexagram, though, just in general, and mostly taken out of commentary here, is well, it's fire on fire. It's illumination on illumination. And so illumination here, fire, is you could take as the fire of life energy, but it's also more specifically the brightness of awareness, the bright light of awareness. Illumination, illuminated mind over illuminated mind. Someone described it as the brightness in which all beings recognize each other. That was also a nice way to describe this whole absolute relative thing. Bright light, or the bright light in which all beings recognize each other. So in China, this double fire hexagram was considered the most complete, the most harmonious, the greatest expression of unity, and the most, in some sense, sort of refined. There was a system with these. You would throw the I Ching, and you would get two trigrams, a hexagram. And depending on how it had, I forget on depending on what, it would play out, maybe it was depending on the hexagram, some lines could move to other lines, and you would then you could say, okay, it can also then secondarily be read as this hexagram and that hexagram, because you can move this line to this position and that line to that position. Most hexagrams could sort of evolve into one or two subsequent visions, hexagrams, that related to the main one. This one has five, so it's one of the most extensively, you might say, it's like each of the other hexagrams would be a commentary on the first one. So this is more information. It sort of carries a great deal of information to the people who are doing I Ching. So it's complete, it's a unified and extensive expression, and it's illumination over illumination. I think that's enough for us to know about here, unless we want to do it ourselves. Was anyone else given to throwing the I Ching in past time? There were present days? You too?
Long time ago.
Long time ago?
Mm-hmm. It's sort of addicting.
Oh, yeah?
I thought so. I mean, you get started on it and sort of you keep going for a while and then.
Oh, we used to sort of do it every year or 6 months or gather around. Did it with Thai a lot. Grew my own. I used yarrow stalks that came out of my field that grew wild in the field so that I could play with the sticks. It was much more fun than the coins because it was more manipulated. At any rate, long time ago. And there are some interesting things in this commentary. I would like sometime to go into the five positions in greater detail, which would mean it maybe even, you know, doing this hexagram out with more detail, because there's a lot of the deeper layers of it from a Chinese perspective had to have meaning for Tozan. Others might not have, but he came out of a world in which this was a sort of a living symbolism with a lot of depth in it. There were yin and yang and active and passive aspects. I think Jen and I mentioned that a little bit. But so the piled up, they become three. The permutations make five. Is this business of elaborating the hexagram? One of the continuing analyses was to look at the upper, lower, and middle lines as three separate trigrams. Because you could say, well, I'll take lines 2, 3, and 4. And what's that? And 3, 4, and 5. And what do those trigrams say? So that was another way of elaborating. And then you would take them in relation to the first. That's what the piled up, they become three means. But we're elaborating our analysis of the hexagram. And the permutations make five is, as I was saying, the way you can do permutations on the hexagram that I completely forget after all these years. And very few hexagrams have five permutations. They usually have a couple. But anyway, this has five. And one way this was taken was that each of the five permutations of this hexagram was taken to represent one of the five positions, which is why sometime with great leisure it would be fun to do it out that way and see what symbol, you know, these five positions are, if you've looked at them, are each one is a mouthful, you know, and they're hard to get at. So having concrete images would be fun to do, to say, well, what's the hexagram that they use for relates to the first position, and what is its meaning? If it's clouds over mountain, it's going to be a lot more accessible in an image way for us. No, not tonight, but it would be fun to do.
When you talk about positions, and I don't know what this means either, but are you talking about Dharma positions?
Yes, that's a good phrase. But there is, I'll tell you, you'll get what I mean, and then you'll come up with another word. Okay. It's a standard. That word is like just a holder. And rank is nice because it's a short word, but it's all wrong. So is there another more pithy word than position that would... So hold the question and answer it for me later. So the other two lines about the five-flavored ear and the five-pronged diamond thunderbolt that we talked about briefly last night are, again, just he's trying to give us graphic images for the way five things can relate as one. So the five-flavored herb, I think, probably wasn't five-spice powder, although who knows, which could have been that. I started with that thinking, well, you know, you have five different spices in different quantities, and they come together as one flavor. But actually, probably, as the commentary, or I think Katagiri's commentary says, it's probably this herb that has a part that's bitter, a part that's and hot, another part that's sweet and sour, another part that's salty. And so one herb has five flavors.
In one of the translations that I read, it was called a hyssop, H-Y-S-S-O-P.
I don't know if it's hyssop. Hyssop is an herb. I have no idea if that's the right one. That's interesting. It's a flowering herb that does grow in Sonoma County, I believe. Because I've certainly heard the name.
Probably
a weedy herb. So in any way, he's saying, think in terms of one plant that has five flavors, for instance, he's saying. For instance, to have five, you can't, each one, in that case, you could say each one is an aspect of the whole, but no, there's the saltiness in it, and there's the bitterness in it, and it is bitter, and it is salty. In this case, so that's a limited image because there are different parts of the plant, but it still gives us some flavor. And then there's the five-pronged diamond thunderbolt. That's the vajra that you know from Tibetan practice. There's a lot of manipulating a vajra. It's a short, it's actually quite a short thing with five prongs on it, and it stands for the diamond, adamantine wisdom. Wisdom as hard as a diamond, unshakable, indivisible wisdom. And for the five Buddha families and all this, so if you have five Buddha families and one diamond thunderbolt, this is another way just of making an image, and it's not the most graphic for those of us who don't really know much about vajras and hyssop, but they're images.
Vajra? Is that what she said?
Vajra.
With a V.
Vajra with a V, which means diamond.
Okay.
Are we in Sanskrit with vajra? I think so. I think we're back in Sanskrit. So those are just images. He's casting about for all different kinds of images that will give us some flavor, some sense of five in one, not separate. And Dogen, I only realized when I was starting to look at this more, Dogen's flower and that became his mon, his symbol. His mon is your insignia, the house of your house, became one of the insignia of Soto Zen, is a five-petaled flower. And he said, five petals open as one flower, make one flower, or one bud opens five petals is one flower, right? So he's, again, this grass is probably relating right back to Tozan's five positions of interpenetration. How are many in one the same and different? So the poem says, the relative and absolute interpenetrate. And in a way, the whole five-position system is an attempt to express interpenetration, to express the relationship of what has been called the relative and absolute. And I said, Katagiri Roshi used those terms, and they never settled well with me. I was always fighting them, chewing it. It's like I've got the bit in my mouth, and I can't quite settle down with it. There's too much superior inferior in it for my ear. And then there was, as Rocky said, absolute smacks of God. You know, what kind of absolute are we talking about here? And then the relative, you know, sounds kind of is lesser for sure than absolute. So what relative in a real sense would mean existing in relation to all others. That's what relative in its most original meaning would be. We have relatives. We may like them or not like them, but it's not lesser to have a relative. It's just what you have, because people are connected to each other. It's just a descriptive term there. So in the same way, we are all, everything is relative in because everything exists in relation to everything else. Nothing exists independently. That's relative versus independent, you might say. In fact, our perception of ourselves as independent is on one hand strong, on the other isolation, alienation, and great suffering. What is meant by what's called relative is all phenomena, because all phenomena, all things, all beings are what exists made out of each other in relation to each other, depending on each other. That's a signal aspect of it. All compounded things, as the original teachings would say. All things that are compounded, that are not unitary. We're all compounded. We're all made of many things and events and so forth. And we exist as compounds, and compounds are related to each other.
In the relative, is there a value? In other words, is there a relative value between things?
Oh, we do that. That's one of the places we go with it. When we have two things, we say, oh, they're different, and then the next one we say is one's better than the other. First one is heavier, one is lighter. Well, that seems like an innocent form of value, relative value. But then we say, I like this one more, and then we say, it's better, and then we say, me first, you second, and we've turned things that naturally exist in relation into a system of comparisons.
Values.
Yeah. But comparisons, comparative values. Okay. Not as sort of absolute value. Every human being has an absolute value of life, right? But this is the comparative value. You're comparatively smarter or older or younger or wiser or poorer or, you know? Living by those comparisons is called suffering. It's called delusion and suffering, because what happens is we believe in them. When I weigh two things, a larger apple and a smaller apple, I don't believe in them. I understand that that's just a descriptive thing. One weighs 4 ounces, one weighs 6 ounces. And then you say, well, I'm hungry, I'll eat the 6 ounce one, or I'm going to share it, I'll eat the 6 ounce one. So there's an innocence in that comparing. It's just, we know we're just comparing on a basis of some one, you could say one value, one issue, one point. But then we start to say, you know, the bigger ones are better, and they acquire kind of a, we believe in those differences. Like, I'm American, and it's better. So all phenomena and all differentiated life is what is meant by this term that begins with an R that we're soon going to give up using. Because it should just mean this in relation to others, it soon became only comparatively real, or relative, only sort of real, because it's only merely relative. And that's where a lot of Buddhism has gone. And in fact, one of the other terms has been the apparent, or the seeming. We don't only seem to be here. We are not what we think we are, but we don't just seem to be here. But what I believe myself to be, what I believe Rocky to be or Kathy to be, doesn't isn't exactly what's actually here. So then we say, well, it's seeming, but we wipe away all of what's of real value by just airbrushing everything out as if everything were seeming because it is compounded. I don't think that's we need to do that. So that old language of relative and absolute, and the absolute was never God in Buddhism, but it, you might say, what I love Uchiyama Roshi's phrase, undeniable reality. That's what it might mean, or the truly real, or emptiness. Emptiness is one of the words. Is absolute was really as a word. Almost an attempt to create a positive sounding word that matched the via negativa of emptiness for the same. Okay. But I really wasn't going to go into it. Maybe we better leave that for now and see if we want to come back.
Can I ask you something?
Hmm.
The non-relative, as opposed to the, instead of calling it absolute, is it what you're saying is one is with the discriminating mind is the relative, and the non-relative would be with no discrimination. So you're not comparing mm-hmm. anything. Everything is. Unified, so to speak.
Okay.
Is that
to some? Okay, that's that. We're going in that direction. But remember, last night Liz was saying this, that idea. You know, here I am in my discriminating mind and my relative and comparing, and it's full of dark and compelling thoughts, and somewhere out just outside of. My field of vision is something that's clean and clear and undifferentiated, and I'm called the absolute, and I want to get there. The problem is, it'll always be somewhere else for as long as we live, because we live in a world of compounded bodies. So something that we call an absolute that's somewhere else is always going to be somewhere else, which is creates duality and leaves us on the suffering, the short end of that stick.
To me, the main phrase that you just said is the body. I mean, as long as you're in a body, you're going to have the something else because you're having your body's in the world and you're having the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mm-hmm. consciousness stuff that comes in our, you know, our sutras about how that is just, it's not bad, it's not good, it's our body and we're in this world in our body.
Now, then, if you go to the Heart Sutra, really, many commentators have said that the first two of those five positions are form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Form being the guest and emptiness the host or the inclusive, the absolute. Okay. Here we are, relative compounded things, right? Empty of some permanent existence. That's emptiness. There is no other emptiness than the emptiness of all compounded things. It doesn't exist somewhere else. Emptiness is the absolute. What is the only thing that's eternal? That all things are empty of having a permanent self. It's right here. That's that insight, that intuitive sense. It's hard to get us to keep track of that somehow the absolute can't be somewhere else. It has to somehow be, in some sense, right here where I am with my deluded thoughts. When the Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, all the five, they're saying quite literally, there are five skandhas, five aspects of self, and the five senses, or the five aspects of self that are body and feeling and consciousness and will and
sensation.
These are just another way of describing the aspects of a living thing, of a living person, especially with the consciousness. we are compounded of many parts. Being compounded of many parts, we are empty of being one unalterable thing. That is what emptiness is. It's not something opposed to form. Forms are made of emptiness, and emptiness is the emptiness of forms. So we can say form is emptiness. All forms are emptiness expressed, are empty of being one thing. And then when it says emptiness is form, it's saying there's no such beast as emptiness hiding behind the curtain. Emptiness is the emptiness of all things. They never were separate. So yes, we are bodies, but it's not that we are only bodies and something empty or absolute is somewhere else. There is no somewhere else. And that's a basic Mahayana position that was really one of the basic differences from Theravadin as it, or the early Buddhism. It really wasn't Theravadin. Theravadin is a later school, but early Buddhism and Mahayana was a sense that there isn't an extinction to go toward a somewhere else. That it's got to be, for there to be anything that's complete and whole, it can't be somewhere else, because it's whatever is somewhere else is partial. There's here and there's there. There is partial as opposed to here.
When you say emptiness, you mentioned the lack of permanence and the lack of a separateness, if you will, being independent of all other things. What else is there that equates to emptiness?
One of us being compounded of many parts. I mean, the fact, you know, we're made of molecules. The molecules are made of atoms. The atoms are made of subatomic particles in a whole lot of empty space. Mm-hmm. You know, so either we see ourselves as 70% water or as 99% air. Hot air. Warm air. So there, you know, in these various ways, we can understand ourselves to be compounded. We are here, and yet we are here. We are, so we can understand ourselves as a pattern, a pretty coherent pattern. Our genome does its best to keep going in the same way, and it gradually makes mistakes over time, and we get deteriorating cells that create in odd ways, and then some of them create as cancer, some of them just as liver spots, you know. But we have, there's a coherence of regeneration. Every cell is replaced. We're not the same person we were in so many ways, and yet there's a pattern and a coherence. So we are a compounded, semi-coherent pattern.
It's kind of like in our bodies, the heart cannot live without the lungs, cannot
right.
live without the
yeah.
kidneys,
yes.
et cetera. So
yes.
they're all, there is
and that was one of the original ways to study compoundedness, that all these parts can't get along without each other. So no one part can exist independent, and the whole can't exist independent without having at least most of these parts intact. You know, there's some you can get away with, do without, but not as well, and not too many of them. So it is not too hard for us to sort of almost analytically, with the minds we already know we have, to see that forms are empty of permanence, and that's what emptiness means, that form is emptiness. So that means that form, all the world of form, is the world of emptiness. They're the same world. They're kind of like superimposed. Samsara and nirvana are superimposed on each other in a classic language. But to say emptiness is form is a little harder. It's a little bit like saying emptiness or absolute, depending how you want to put it, has no separate existence apart from all the little mushrooms. Emptiness expresses as each of us and nowhere else and in no other way. Expresses as every compounded thing, because it's all things are compounded and they are empty. So you could say, then people say, well, emptiness or impermanence is only... People say impermanence is the only thing that's permanent, right? Because impermanence keeps going. You can pretty much count on it. You know, so you could say impermanence is eternal, and many books will say that. You can also say that emptiness is eternal, or endless, or what is most real is the emptiness of things, or the law of cause and effect is more real, is the realest thing, and yet it's not apart from each example of it. Each being is a full flowering example. Manifestation of the whole law of cause and effect, of impermanence, interdependence.
Okay. Reality flowing.
Reality constantly flows. There may be one reality constantly flows as all the brooks. So in the Sandokai, the merged harmony of difference and sameness, where it says the branching streams flow on in the dark, well, the dark is a way of saying the emptiness or absolute or oneness that you can't really see clearly. Mm-hmm. And in darkness, in the world of darkness, all the branching streams are continuing to flow when you can't see them. And then conversely, in the light, in the bright light, how did that line go? The line that in bright light we see all the differences. That one bright illuminating light shows us all the differences. There's two versions of the same statement, those two lines. So I don't like the language of relative and absolute, and I don't like the language of apparent versus real. Because they create a versus where it really isn't opposition. Saying, oh, maybe particular and universal, or phenomena and one, are ways of teasing apart these very important different aspects, ways of seeing, how things are. If we only see things in terms of the differences, we're driven by the need to live on the network shopping channels, you know. Because we're seeing in terms of differences what we have, what we don't have, what we want to have. It's a great form of suffering. Then we live only by the comparative values, for instance. And so we want to find some deeper meaning or value. We say there's a value to each human life, or there's a shared quality, or there's the equality of all things I've talked about. All of these are ways to say there's something that isn't defined. We are not defined only by our differences and by comparative values. And in the language of the harmony of difference and sameness, they use a Chinese version of expression there, which is principle and phenomena. Remember the lines, phenomena exist like box and lid fitting, principle responds like arrow points meeting. This principle is meaning unified understanding or absolute or the principle of things. That it's not really behind things, the principle in things. It's difficult for us to get past our way of thinking that sees something we want to, that we call an absolute or truth over there, and my confused, deluded life over here, or my compounded life over here. But first, then it's always somewhere else, forever. You put it out there, I'm here and it's there. If I move, it moves. You don't somehow get to where somewhere else is. You're always here and there's always a there. And it kind of makes your life unreal. That's absolutely real. What am I? Something that's not real? Is your suffering merely apparent? I don't think so. Pain is very real. So, but pain is real, and the of all kinds, the pain of being driven and compelled by differences and oppositions and thirsting and grasping is very, very real. It's a very great form of suffering, and including the exclusivity of rejecting the body as unreal. That's a form of suffering. That's not the Dharma. So I tend to use the word universal a lot as a way of having a word for what someone that isn't absolute as something else. Universal means it's everywhere, as I like it better. We're talking about the same things, principle, real, true, or absolute. Dogen's Shobo Genzo, the Sho in Shobo Genzo is the Japanese version of this word, which is translated generally as true. It's called the true Dharma, treasury treasury of the eye of the true Dharma. And then on the other side, not as opposed, but the other side would be many phenomena, or the particular, universal and particular, or individual, or the many phenomena. So we could say that the universally true or universally real, and what is particular, the myriad interdepending phenomena, are completely interpenetrated. This is where we're coming back to. That whatever you call two visions or views, two sides, two windows on life, seeing in terms of non-differentiated or universal life, the energy of life, the force of life, I'll go to all kinds of extents to pick up, and no one word will work for too long, because then we fix on it, you know. The one and the many are completely interpenetrated, completely not two. They do not have separate existences. And we want that, because if they have separate existences, we have a great deal of suffering, because we are then separated off, opposed, and locked into that. So it says, everything depends on everything else. And it says, this world of myriad beings and myriad events, is the one and only expression of what is always so, what is the not depending on relative circumstance. The law of cause and effect comes up as all of us and nowhere else. That is the only thing that is universally true. So it can be called the law of cause and effect, and be called by all these different names. Whatever is way we describe the non-differentiated, totally universal truth of things, it exists in and as, not just in, but as each individual being and thing. And so then we have, that's why when Tozen, the first time I met him at Hokyoji, when he said there is no absolute reality apart from each individual thing, and in fact I think he tends to shake his hand as he does it, right? There is no absolute reality apart from each individual thing as it really is. Oh, I didn't have to understand some other absolute world. Whatever is absolute is not apart from each individual thing in its realistness. What's that? So it begs the question, but that's okay. We're always going to have more questions, because words will never completely express it. So then interpenetration is, what is the relationship of when we see something we call an absolute reality or true reality or truth and all the wee sleeked beasties, all the myriad, limited, compounded, Meshuggah creatures. What's that relationship? Interpenetration is a name for it, and then is a way of trying to look at that ball of fire. And his whole thing of five positions, which is all five positions of what's called a host and guest, perhaps, or universal in particular, is a way of saying everything is meeting everything else. Now, that's also the world of, in any, whether everything is always meeting everything else, and everything is always the many meeting the one. All these meetings are endless. Every dependent thing, depending on every other, is always meeting every other. We're always meeting, encountering all the, that's what it is to be dependent stuff. All the conditioned stuff. We're always meeting each other, bumping up against each other, smacking each other upside the head, but we're meeting. We're all the time. And we are always, whatever the universal meaning the particular, and the particular meaning the universal, within us and between us. So How are we going to do that? So this five positions is trying to look at. And also I think at some point it would be interesting to see if we can derive some nourishment for ourselves from it in greater detail. He's describing this again in the lines, subtly included within the truth, drumming and singing fit together. Subtly included within the truth are all things. All things are subtly included within the truth. Nothing is left out. This is an inclusive universe. No one and nothing is left out. The whole includes all sides, although each side feels itself to be complete. The whole is not true reality of non-differentiatedness. No, true the whole is the integration of what's that universalness and particularness, you might say. That's what's the real integration. That's why the old title of the Sandokai was The Merging of Difference and Unity. There was a nice quality to that. That was this Cleary's translation, because where we now have the harmony of difference and sameness. Difference, that's another nice one. You can use difference and sameness instead of relative and absolute. We're talking about the same two sides. And we make the mistake of thinking, over here is my complicated messiness, and there's something, even if it's something in me or something called the universal, but actually our practice is about integration. Not about abandoning the world of the myriad and of compoundedness and what's Kaylin going to have for breakfast and do I want to have a child anyway? You know, all of that. and then we say this is so complicated and seems and it burdens us so we want to understand things from the non-differentiated side. We're all Buddha, or Buddha nature is a name for that. We want to see in those terms. But our practice really is about integrating both sides. So that when we're seeing from the eyes of our differences, that we still see the universal, that we still see Buddha and Dharma in each other, while knowing ourselves as individual, we sleek-eyed beasties. And when seeing or trying to think in terms of what is universal or unity or one or absolute or true, that we see that it is all the mushrooms in the field.
The Buddha nature that you're speaking of, that's not just the non-differentiated, that's the integration, right? And
Buddha nature is perhaps our capacity of all of us to be Buddha, that we already are of the stuff that can develop as Buddha, you might say. So it's a slightly different window on the same thing. Mm-hmm. From a slightly different perspective. So yes, it's a window on the same thing from the perspective maybe of Buddha and practice. Huh?
I mean, I can hear that question. It's yeah. Like, does Buddha nature, then somehow are you purified and not a and not the interpenetrated collection of the myriad and the...
I would say then Buddha nature may be more, as you say, of the integration. Buddha nature is not something apart from all the, you can't be compassionate without a hand to do it with. You know, it needs the developing, practice. You can't do practice without having a body. You can't do a Buddha practice of Zazen without doing it in a body, in a particular body at a particular time. And that makes it feel limited. You can only do it for a little while and the legs hurt and all, but that's the only way to do it. It's still the whole. Subtly included within the truth, drumming and singing fit together. One of the old commentaries, because someone brought it up when we had this translation workshop some, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, that produced these the main translations that we're using these days, said that this original allusion in Chinese, in Chinese to drumming and singing, came from an image of the teacher drums and the student hears it and sings. That it was an interaction of mentoring, and how we all learn, that someone, this is one of the beauties of compounded interdependent life that we can see, no matter how painful our interdependent compounded life can feel, that it is one limited being, one person drumming, and another hears it and sings. Drumming and singing fit together. This is the call and response universe. One calls out, another responds. That's out of each compounded limited being. The call goes out, or the Buddha nature call and the Buddha nature response comes back. The fit together in drumming and singing fit together is exactly the same as principle response, like arrow points meeting. The two poems are talking about the same. How is it that things really actually fit together? We don't experience it that way because in our limited, compounded, coming together and falling apart way, things don't always fit together. But there is a way in which, at the same time, everything is as it is, and there's a kind of fitting together that's going on. Which is often it's been described in Zen terms, and also in other, maybe other Buddhist traditions, as according with the Dharma, or according with reality. Bodhidharma, and the one text we have that's pretty authentically his, this foundational Zen text, speaks of our aim as to accord with the Dharma, to be according, I like that as an active verb, with reality as it is. That's the time of no friction. That's as far as we're going to go tonight. We're not going to go into those five positions. We want to hit on them a little tomorrow night, we can.
When Tozen refers to one essence and then multiple times in the poem, it, is that what he's referring
it
to?
It is the Dharma of thusness, or of things as... Thusness is these vague thusness and suchness. Some people say they mean different things, the same thing. Are words that are trying to... bring that to express the interpenetrated, integrated world, because each thing is thus, and the thusness of each thing is itself in its sort of complete, undifferentiated nature, while also being an individual thing. So the thusness of all things is, you might say, the universal or integrated aspect. The universal aspect, the thusness of all things. So the thusness tends to be more trying to describe the universal in a way that relates to thingness. Yeah, so it's kind of trying to integrate the two.
And playing devil's advocate.
All right.
In looking at it practically and living one's life, why does it matter?
Because if we don't, we're liable to fall into believing that things just being different from each other is all there is. In either materialism or fundamentalism in religion, those are all, or Marxism or the science. I grew up in a household that was so materialistic it was crazy. It had not a lot of stuff, but a Marxist and a scientist, it was a material world. There was no talk, they had values, but there was no talk of that. But you either get that highfalutin version of materialism, or you get thing-driven life, and where we're compelled by the differences and the wants, and we don't understand that there's another way to relate to the things other than to want and reject them. We live in terms of grasping and rejecting. That's suffering. And we need some way to shine a light to say, yes, we are all these different beings, and that is precious. And yet that is not, in some sense, the differentness of us is of great value. But if we understand that we are also non-universal or equal or non-different or thus, then we can also understand the very differentness in a better light, frankly, in a larger light. Then... and I'm not just being opposed to and wanting to get better grades than or whatever it is. I want to appreciate the differences and enjoy. There's enjoyment in the differences then, instead of just compulsion and being driven by them. So it informs not only are we not only different from each other, but informs the way it is, enlarges the sense of being individual and different. So I think it's a much better, it gives us more of a basis for values, for instance, and for really understanding, relating to each other in a larger and deeper way, and to ourselves. I don't want to just, I am a collection of parts, and I want to understand how that is something of value. And then understanding that, find a way to relate through that. So, and that's why when the words get too much, and the when this universal in particular, we say, as Katagiri always did, please sit down and shut up. Sit zazen. Sit down, be quiet. Experience. Zazen is intended to be an experience of that integrated. One sleeked beastie full of many achy parts or many confusing parts and many achy thoughts. And how, especially with this mind, how am I going to inhabit this mind? Not simply try to clear it away. Inhabit this mind and yet not be just compelled. And understand that also the compulsion will keep happening forever. That perfection, aiming at perfection and never being compelled is also not a human thing. But that's the other, Tozen's other great teaching, is that he's hopelessly compelled by empty thoughts. And therefore he does not have to waste his time on his endless goddamn perfectionism, which he has a bad case of. And that was driving his life. And he was going to be perfect, and perfect Zen, and and then he realized that he's hopeless Tozen, that he's hopelessly compelled by empty thoughts, and therefore his job is to keep waking up to that and doing his best, not trying to be something called perfect. It freed him to really practice more effectively as a human being, rather than trying to leave human being behind and become perfect.
So in Buddhist terms, that is the ultimate truth, is thusness. The ultimate reality is the reality of that.
Of this integrated, interpenetrated universe.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what else would there be?
There isn't, but there. Since Buddhism is intended originally as a description of what is the natural universe, and how does a human being live in those terms? And as I say, what we think of as the natural universe has shifted a little in 2,500 years. And if we don't let it shift, boy, that's fundamentalism. So, the intent behind one particular view of what's a natural universe with rebirths or things of that sort is it's a natural universe. And what is the whole Buddhism is, what does it mean to live as a human being as fully as possible on the basis of a living in a natural universe? Whether it's described in terms of getting out of it, or bodhisattva returning endlessly, or just dealing with it in this lifetime, those are all languages for the same larger intention. And that's why it's about ending suffering. And it's not going to eradicate suffering as long as there are suffering beings. But it's about that, what does it mean to live as a human being, and how to see where human suffering comes from and how to end it.
I think that's what religions are about.
Right, but many religions do it by positing another world to go to. And for people who live, you know, if I were a slave picking cotton in the South in the 18th century, I would have desperately needed a religion that told me that there was a better world than this to go to after I died, and I'd be reunited with the people I'd been separated from on an auction block. That would have been absolutely the only religion that could have made any sense to me. But the religions are all trying to deal with human suffering. What is the value of human life, and how to stand up in human life? But a lot of them are doing it in terms. What are the terms in which we're doing it?
Some of us are making choices to use one set of vocabulary versus another. I mean, and there are, I'm not saying there aren't differences, but
yeah.
I feel that the basic questions that we're trying to, or the impulses in our nature, in our human nature.
Well, that's why Buddhism finally got called a religion, because it's not a religion in terms of any of the other criteria like God. Pretty much every other religion has one god or many gods, usually a creator god. You know, all the Abrahamic religions do. And so it's still hard to have conversations because we don't have a theology. And they didn't want to see Buddhism as a religion. But we eventually it was said, look, but it's about the same human issues, and you know, so it's it
and
is.
Also, when you come after, when you then come across thusness, suchness, the inconceivable, something or other, that, you know, how is that so different than God?
Because it's not somewhere else. Because it's not somewhere else, Liz. That's why.
Well,
okay.
But you don't know what people, everyone who's using the word God means by it.
Oh, right. Well, sometimes,
and
yeah.
So,
yeah.
And yeah. There's just as many variations of on that theme. I mean, on what a person is imbuing it with as what we are imbuing. Suchness and
there are many, many versions.
And streams of reality. Yeah. And so,
well,
you know.
There are people who don't, there are Christians, there are universities, the Unitarians don't believe in God either, anyway. Or they do believe in God but don't call themselves Christians. I always get it confused which it is. And they vary too from one to another. But by and large, even with most people in the Abrahamic religions who believe in an immanent God also believe in a God that's not only immanent, but somehow out there or started life or created the world in some form or it gave the world its moral codes or things like that. Those are, tend to be the things that most of the Christian and Islamic and a lot of Judaism is about.
And there's not just the thought, I think, of there being a transcendent being that people
okay.
pray to or go to. There's also the thought of transcendence of your self
yeah.
and an existence of a separate self in the form mm-hmm. of a soul. And that's very
right.
Important.
So that's the one of the corollaries is the
religions.
And it varies a lot, but there's a tendency to
it. I just think
the transcendence.
For the ordinary Joe,
yeah.
who maybe is outside of a structure of a formal religion,
mm-hmm.
they're using the word God sometimes as a repository.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, it means many things.
Yeah.
And aspirations,
so. Yeah.
vows.
Yeah. I think so.
Or the recognition that there's something bigger than.
Right.
Myself.
It's a word for recognizing
yeah,
there's something bigger than what I normally see myself as. That's why when they do polls and it turns out that 90% of people believe in God, it's because when people are asked, they don't want to say, I don't believe in anything larger than myself. So they say, I believe in God, because it's a shorthand for that. Because they don't have another language for it. Yeah, I think that's true.
How about the word, instead of ranks, I like to think they're insects. That they were embodied at one point in a revelation of some sort. You know, that a way, like you were using the word windows, that
mm-hmm.
someone or over time these were embodied epiphanies almost, or insights. Or
mm-hmm. The five epiphanies. The five epiphanies? I don't know.
I was thinking views, because it has sights, windows, perspectives.
I don't like views are opinions. So much. I mean, that's such a loaded word again. If they were views like vistas, five vistas, how's that kind of sense of views? How about that? The five vistas.
How about the 10 getaways?
The five getaways. The five opposites of getaways. The five get-ins.
The five faces.
The five faces.
Five what?
Five facets. But see, that's five separate facets of one thing, and each one is the whole thing.
There's no word.
The five.
Spaces. Five.
Spaces?
Yeah.
The five spaces. But they're not separate spaces. Nor are they five aspects. That's why it's... Well, at some point, whether we look at it tonight or tomorrow night or we don't, we'll maybe we'll come up, we'll look at them and see what we... What, we'll have to find some word. We'll call them all George. I don't know.
Five Georges.
I mean, you'd want to have something in your life where you'd say, aha.
The five ahas.
The five petals of the one flower.
Well,
I don't
that
know.
That means something to you.
Yeah.
That they're not just descriptions on a page.
Yeah,
but
and so they're
they
not just...
give
right.
you some insight into
something in the word.
Yeah, because also, not only do they give insight, but their particular way of set of thought. There are many positions and views and vistas. So the reason ranks has held is because nothing else was called the five ranks, so that people know what it's referring to. That's why the five Georges would also work. So the five petals would work of the one flower, maybe, or the...
God.
Words are tough.
Oh, yeah. That's what's so funny.
Okay, we better stop. It's getting late.